Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University and the studios of WMOT-FM on the campus. In the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, barn dance radio spread country and western music nationwide. Its comforting, authentic sounds soothed the soul of a nation first down on its luck and then later fighting overseas. The origins of the country music industry can be traced to the barn dance radio shows on WLS, WSM, and other stations, and women played a major role in both the style and the substance of those programs. Dr. Chris McCusker, Associate Professor of History at MTSU, tells the story of some of these women, including the legendary Minnie Pearl, in her book Lonesome Cowgirls and Honky Tonk Angels, The Women of Barn Dance Radio from the University of Illinois Press. Chris, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
At the risk of being simplistic, let's start out with a working definition of barn dance radio, if you would. And how is it different from what you would hear today if you tuned in to the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, the original barn dance shows appeared in urban areas where there was a large southern migrant class living there. A lot of rural southerners moved to places like Chicago, Cincinnati, Detroit, Nashville, from the rural areas. And so the audience that it catered to, first of all, was a very different one than the audience that country music caters to today. So that's the first difference. The second thing about it is that it was based on a Saturday night ritual, the Saturday night dance party, that was very prevalent in rural areas. And it tended to focus on a different kind of music than you hear on the radio these days. It was string band music, so harmonicas, mandolins, fiddles, banjos, guitars. But it was also more of a variety show, meaning that there was comedy, there were stories told, there was and music interspersed throughout. The Opry these days is a version of that, certainly, but there's less comedy, more dancing, although there was dancing in the 30s on WLS Chicago. The Opry also tends to focus on more, obviously, contemporary stars who sing to a different audience, who use different kinds of instruments, who have a different image in mind when standing on stage. So while certainly it comes from the barn dance genre, it has changed and evolved with the times.
Country music has been criticized over the years for being sexist, for using women as props rather than respecting them as artists. But you don't really write about these seven women you profile in the book as feminist trailblazers. Mm-hmm. What do you think these women brought to the table in addition to their talent as entertainers?
I should mention that if there's like sexist props, then all of entertainment should be challenged in that regard. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. That what these women did was it wasn't feminist. And to most people who don't truly understand what feminism is, feminists seem weird, odd, radical. But they also weren't, and they had those ideas were not in their head. But they weren't at home singing to babies and cooking either. What they did is they brought an image of comfort to the stage, starting with Linda Parker on WLS Chicago in 1932, that they were willing to stand on stage and sing to their listeners in a way that was soft and melodic and referenced that image of mom being at home and taking care of the family and comforting them in a moment when things were rough. You know, the Great Depression, 25% unemployment nationwide, 50% unemployment in Chicago, where Linda Parker was singing. And so what women brought to the table was an ability to seem natural, genuine, authentic, uncommercial, that they weren't out to make a buck. What they were there to do was to act like mom and to be comforting like mom. And in fact, they could do some profoundly commercial things that men couldn't do as obviously because they seemed so anti-commerce. The girls of the Golden West, for example, were able to sing an entire show and make it be commercial in ways that guys couldn't do it. Because men were associated with commerce more than women were.
Did they sing the commercials, like Go Get a Goo Goo, It's Good, or the way Flatt and Scruggs used to sing You Bake Right with Martha White?
Well, what they would do is that if there was a square dance segment, they would cut away, and so the people singing on stage would not seem to be selling something, that what they would seem to be doing is that they would be singing and being comforting and non-commercial. Then they'd split away and say, hey, that you should buy this product that's bringing you this show. But what the girls of the Golden West, who were cowgirl singers in the 30s, very famous, actually. They had their own show in New York City for a while. The other performers, what they did was they made the whole show seem nostalgic and old and made you feel good. And then the announcers would get on and say, Pinex cough syrup has brought you this old-time stuff. And you wanted to go out and reaffirm or get that feeling back again. And Pinex was the way to do that when the radio was turned off. So these women sort of set a tone or an atmosphere, if you will, of warmth and comfort. And people figured out, at least inexplicitly, that you could go replicate that off stage by going and buying some cough syrup.
Without there having to be the pitch people up front.
Exactly.
They did not take the Ed McMahon
exactly.
role.
They did not. And in fact, that was the point. And they were very successful in selling lots of Pinex cough syrup. I should note too that image of therapy, of therapeutic images, of crooning, of comfort, it also meant only certain kinds of sponsors could sponsor these shows. So it was medicinal stuff, things that would make your life better. Aladdin mantle lamps, for example, they made your life brighter because literally they brought light into the home. Medicine, Alka-Seltzer was a huge sponsor of barn dance shows because it was a medicinal thing that made you feel better, like the performers were making you feel better too.
It seems that all of the developing media borrow from their most modern predecessor, the way television borrowed from radio, and radio took its cue from vaudeville, and barn dance radio took its cue from vaudeville too, in large part, minus the burlesque component, because that audience probably wouldn't have put up with anything too gosh awfully racy. I don't know, that maybe there are little subtle double entendre in there mm-hmm. somewhere, but not, certainly not the stripper component of it. Wouldn't work on radio anyway. Talk about the vaudeville influence and how it manifested itself.
Well, when radio started, when the barn dance shows started in 1924, the broadcasters nationwide had no idea what to do with radio. Radio was a wide open field, and certainly you're correct that they borrowed from other stages, movies, even though movie is something you see and a radio is something you hear, because they understood that radio would eventually have a visual effect as well through this magazines, through personal appearances that the performers would make. And so they borrowed heavily from the image to create the visual portion of it from movies. From vaudeville, though, they took what worked and redid it. So they used to have, vaudeville was a very eclectic kind of performance. It traveled the country. Even the smallest towns across the nation had what was known as opera houses because they knew that there would be a traveling troupe coming through soon that would perform to them, and that these troupes would bring the latest entertainment from New York or Chicago to their small towns. And that entertainment, again, would be very eclectic. You could have a dog act. You could have a couple twins sitting there playing on saxophones. Bob Hope got his start there. Jack Benny got his start there. And it was live, pretty rowdy in some cases, theater. That was then, they took the parts that could be heard. So you can't do a dog act on the air because they can't see it. It was too visual. But the music really worked because it was something people were familiar with and worked in an auditory medium.
Like yeah, da 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 with a country accent.
Sure, sure. But there was also the stock characters that they could take from the vaudeville stages. The cowgirl was a big hit, Mommy Gray and Annie Oakley being the two most prominent images. The sentimental song, the song where it causes you to cry and long and mourn for home and things like that. The sentimental singer was someone who was a very prominent image on vaudeville stages. The whole point was to stand up there and make you cry. But it's a vocal performance that was very easily translated. And it's interesting that many of the original performers were all vaudeville performers. Dave Makin from the Grand Ole Opry was a vaudeville performer. Grace Wilson, the girl with a million friends on WLS Chicago, she was a very, very early performer on the Chicago shows, because she was able to take what she knew from standing on vaudeville stages and translate it to the radio, as was Dave Makin.
Let's talk about some of these women individually. Mm-hmm. Linda Parker, how ironic is it that a girl who was labeled incorrigible in high school ended up in this kind of sweetheart role on mm-hmm. stage?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it's very difficult to actually recreate her life. In fact, she's a... historians like mysteries, and she's the best mystery in the unsolved mystery, if you will, in the book, because we've got some documents. We know that the image she performed on stage was not her real life, but exactly what that was is a little unclear. She was born in central Indiana, not in Kentucky, as it was performed on stage. Her parents may not have been married or when she was born. She was kicked out of high school for being a quote-unquote, as you mentioned, incorrigible youth. We don't know why. And she was performing in nightclubs when she was discovered by John Lehrer, who was a producer at WLS Chicago. And, you know, one of the things he would later say is that, you know, he rescued her from that horrible life and created this wholesome atmosphere for her to be able to perform on and in. At the same time, though, the whole point of hiring someone like Linda Parker was that, you know, sex sold. They knew that from vaudeville, and they knew that from movies. And you couldn't have the Cumberland Ridge Runners, John Lehrer's group, without having a girl, as they were called at the time, a girl singer. And girl singers were there because they were pretty.
Just like in the big bands, Tommy Dorsey,
exactly.
Glenn Miller.
Exactly. Yeah, all the singers, Doris Day got her start doing that. So, yeah, they knew they needed somebody on stage who was pretty and who sang well. And at the same time, they also needed someone who could work with microphones. Microphones changed the way rural singers sang. Very famous stories about Lily Mae Ledford and Lulu Bell Wiseman showing up, being used to performing in front of live audiences and projecting. You don't project on the radio because it overwhelms the mics.
Right.
And when they got up on stage to audition for the first time, they had serious, significant problems with the microphone because they didn't understand that they didn't need to shout anymore. And Linda Parker whose real name was Jean Munich, didn't have to learn that lesson. And she had the soft sort of crooning voice that Rudy Valley and Bing Crosby had made very popular in the late 20s and early 30s. And that was the standard for radio. But when she sang it, it wasn't this sort of sexy guy singing to you in your ear sort of thing. When Bing Crosby and Rudy Valley sang, it was the mother crooning to her babes.
Yeah.
Because she sang so softly and so melodically.
The Girls of the Golden West, a.k.a. Million Dolly Good, whose signature song was Will There Be Any Yodelers in Heaven, were they taken as seriously as a yodeling singer like Jimmy Rogers, or did people just sort of look at them and say, oh, novelty act?
Oh, certainly not. Because in the mid-1930s, Western stars were as popular or more popular than the Southern stars were on stage. Gene Autry got his start in early 1930s on WLS. Patsy Montana, in the depths of the Great Depression, sold a million copies of her song, I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart, in which she yodeled. Yodeling was very serious musical stuff in the 1930s. And so the Girls of the Golden West were very much seen as being very innovative, very professional, very commercial, at least by the broadcasters who were putting them on air. And as I said earlier, they had a 15-30 minute show in New York City for a little while, and they performed with Rudy Valley on his show in New York City. They were that good and that serious of performers.
If you were a little girl listening to Barn Dance Radio and you heard Million Dolly, would you think, then you go to the movies and you see Dale Evans or something, and then you fantasize, mm-hmm. even though Dale didn't yodel, would you then, you know, fantasize about being a cowgirl yourself?
Oh, sure. And the thing about cowgirls, the thing about putting Southerners and Westerners on the stage together, that both were seen as pre-industrial places. There's no industry, there are no factories, there are no bread lines, there are no unemployment in the West and the South. And so somebody imagining going out with Dale Evans or the Girls of the Golden West and riding on the range, they get to escape the Great Depression. And very imaginatively, certainly. You know, there's plenty of industry in the West. But for many people who had never been there, that image was a comfort to them. And it was certainly an escapist sort of fantasy for them. So, little girls and little boys alike, that was a way to get away from having to do paper routes.
Yeah.
That helped the family, for example.
Lily Mae Ledford. So how, through the Roosevelt administration policy, she came to symbolize sort of the president's desire to thaw out the isolationist freeze before Pearl Harbor?
Sure. Yeah. One of the things Roosevelt knew was very good at is understanding the use of culture and symbol and words.
And the radio through and his fireside chats.
Sure. And I mean, think about it. The fireside chats were just an outstanding mechanism for him. First of all, Herbert Hoover, the president preceding Roosevelt, had set up the FCC and was the first media president. He used the radio, but he'd get up and he'd say, "There's no Great Depression," or "People make more money selling apples on the streets," and he just didn't understand how to use it. Roosevelt took the lessons that other people had already learned on the air. He didn't speak to them in people listening in derogatory ways. He would say, "My friends," or he would use the informal, "You have nothing to fear," sort of thing. And Barn Dance Radio had been at the cutting edge of figuring this out. And so Hoover had one corresponding secretary to answer all the mail from the public. Roosevelt had 76 secretaries to answer that mail. And, you know, we don't know if this is true or not, but it was said he got 100,000 letters a month.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So he understood the use of words. He also understood when Congress was against his plans, he'd go tell the plan straight to the public, and the public would put pressure on their congressional representatives to pass Roosevelt's plans. So Roosevelt was very good and very adept at words, to the point that one of the British prime ministers, Chamberlain, wrote to his sister that it's always best and wisest to trust nothing from the, or to expect nothing from the Americans except words. And so with a rigid anti-globalism in the 1930s, the isolationism, "We are not going to war." World War I had caused this Great Depression. People using the radio would tell people. And so it was very, very much not going to war. "We'll sell you the gun. We're not going to shoot it for you," mm-hmm. sort of mentality. And so Roosevelt knew he had to get some changes done in mindset before he could actually declare war on Germany. And so he used Lily Mae Ledford as a way to at least proclaim who our allies would be if we were involved in a global war. And he chose the British because World War II was an airplane war.
Mm-hmm.
If Hitler decided to attack us, our last defense was no longer this big, huge ocean between us and Europe. It was Britain. And so because the airplane changed everything. And in fact, in the Roosevelt papers, there are many, many descriptions of airplanes, British air power in there, because they were very worried about whether or not the British could counter the Nazis. So for him, the natural ally, because we shared a common culture, because they had been allies with us in World War I, the natural ally was Britain. He couldn't be assured, though, that everyone in the United States would be pro-British. We had a large German-American population, as well as an Italian-American population. We had a vehemently anti-British population amongst the Irish Catholic Americans. And major corporations in the United States were selling to the Nazis. DuPont, GM, mm-hmm. Ford were all selling to the Nazis. And in fact, during World War II, Kaiser Aluminum was still selling to the Nazis.
So where does Lily Mae come in here?
Well, Lily Mae, you know, these women on the stage, the Southern performers, were seen as isolated mountaineers. And those mountaineers had kept The British, they had been descendants of the British colonists coming over during the 1600s and 1700s, and they had kept the British folk music pure and sacrosanct and sacred, and it was free from any outside influence, an image certainly, not reality. And so by putting Lily Mae Ledford up on stage in June of 1939, when British royalty, the King and Queen of England, came to the United States for the very first visit by British royalty to the United States ever, the point of putting her on stage, even though only dignitaries got to see her perform, was to say, this is our ally here, folks. We sing the same music. We share this common musical language. She's singing British ballads here. Here's the British king in our audience here.
Yeah.
You know, what's really interesting is, first of all, this was reported widely in the papers. They made the New York Times, and editorialists recognized what he was trying to do.
Did the British get the connection?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy, did they. They did it on purpose. And in fact, the first conversations about Lend-Lease, the program where Roosevelt gave old military weapons and equipment to the British, were discussed with the British king that time.
Well, it makes sense that the people in the mountains and the hollers would be the preservers of these traditions they got from the motherland. Geography would be a factor, if nothing else, because if you're down in the holler before the age of modern transportation and communication, you ain't going anywhere, right?
True, but there was a lot of out-migration. So Lily Mae Ledford was one of 14, and there was a record player in her holler, so she heard Jimmy Rogers when she was growing up. A couple of her brothers were sent out to go work in the coal mines and then come back, and they brought back versions of Banjo Pickin' Girl, which is her signature song, and radio. You know, you didn't have to own a radio to listen to it. A local store would buy one, and everyone would gather together in that store and listen to the radio. There's a very famous story in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. Her grandmother owned a little dry goods store in Stamps, Arkansas, and she had a radio. And the night Joe Louis won heavyweight champion in the 1930s, the entire community gathered at the store and listened to the radio. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we would, and there are letters in John Lehrer's papers from little service station owners saying, I own the only radio for 140 miles around, and everybody gathers at my store every Saturday night to listen to your program. So isolated, sure.
But it became an electronic campfire.
It sure did. Yeah, that's a great way to say it. Yeah, it sure did. People were isolated, but it was in a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, been reading stories about the Norris Dam area, and the grocery store guys there would go to Knoxville every week, pick up stuff, and then come back and sell mm-hmm. it to the areas and to the folks living in Campbell County and Claiborne and all in those areas. Mm-hmm. So isolated, sure. Difficult to get out, sure. In a vacuum, no way.
Okay. Let's move on to Minnie Pearl.
Sure.
Before we lose our time here. I mean, if it was tough to be a woman stand-up comic in the 1960s, how hard was it to be one in the 1930s and 40s? And talk about having to learn how to work the mic when you say, yeah. Howdy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, but keep in mind there were plenty of people that came before her. The spinster gossip, the old maid gossip, was a stock character from vaudeville, and she followed in some pretty big shoes. Marie Dressler, for example, from vaudeville. She had plenty of people that she could have learned from. Plus, those little opera houses that dotted the country where the vaudeville shows would come through. The Sewell Company, for which she would go to work for in the 1930s, would come through in the teens and 20s, and she saw those stock characters. So, and then on the Opry, Sari and Sally were there, and they were performers in the 1930s, very popular, sitting there gossiping. And so it didn't seem like she was a stand-up comedian. She was there to sit and have a visit with everybody, you know?
Was that the only character a comedian could absorb? I mean, back then, unless you were doing the sex symbol, va-va-va-voom kind of character in a vaudeville skit or something like that. I mean, could she have just gotten up there and told one-liners in the climate of the day, do you think? Or did the role just happen to be the one that suited her?
Well, in many ways, it's one that suited her. Sarah and Sally, one of them was an old maid, the other one was a widow. So there couldn't be a husband around unless it was a dual team. On country stages, I'm trying to think if there were any team, and I can't think of any on Opry stages or barn dance stages. Certainly, Burns and Allen on New York-based radio. Yes. Certainly,
Where Gracie was the ditzy wife who wasn't really ditzy at all. She was very smart,
brilliant. She was. So what she was able to do was where she got her practice was in front of military audiences, and it was visiting military installations where the guys were drunk, they were scared. And they were very aggressive with her. And she learned how to manage those audiences. And that's when she learned how to stand in front of a stage and really seasoned her act. Mm-hmm. Became very famous. She figured out how to have fun with their ideas about who should stand up there. And when she went to the military station, she'd say, "Now, I just felt so welcomed when I came here because there were guys waiting for me. They had my initials even on their arms. Wow. MP, Minnie Pearl." And we'd get to the gates and they'd searched every card, searched and searched until they found me. And it got to be a joke that followed her from camp to camp. Mm-hmm. And the guys would yell, "Tell us about the MPs." Mm-hmm. And after the war was over, she'd have fans come up to her and say, "You know when the last time I saw you was?" And she'd say, "No, when?" And the guy would say, "Well, when I was in basic training at this camp or this camp." And so I think that's really where the Opry really started to become popular, was sending those troops out on the road and to those military installations.
Yeah. You could probably do a book on this subject in and of itself, but how did all of this seemingly more innocent time morph itself into today's corporate country culture?
Oh, you know, I honestly think that there was a lot of corporate stuff in the 1930s. Lulu Bell Wiseman would not have been the top female radio performer of all genres in 1936 if there wasn't a heavy corporate atmosphere already there. Because what that does is it creates an infrastructure whereby she can be heard. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of corporate atmosphere, certainly. But she had managers. She had publicity, a press that was backing her. She had contracts that she had to sign and follow through with. And there was a lot of money to pay her when she was going out on the road. You know, the days of the handshake and being paid by a sip from the producer's jug were long gone by the time the 1930s came around. It seems more intense now because it's bigger. It's more controlled, certainly. There are no A&R, but it's a different industry too. It's not radio anymore. It's A&R or record based. And that means something different than what it was in the 30s and 40s.
But women can adapt different kinds of roles in their in country music performance today. They are not limited to the sweetheart, the spinster, the so-and-so and so. As a matter of fact, they don't even really have to be comforting, as we can found out with the Dixie Chicks. They can be very bold.
Yeah, that's true. But one of the interesting things is how much the sentimental mother is still there. Leanne Womack a couple years ago was quoted on 103 saying that if she wasn't a country music star, she'd love to be a stay-at-home mom. That image of being a mommy is still very crucial. I mean, think about Faith Hill. She's got three kids. They go on the road with them. Their fans, both Tim McGraw and Faith Hill's fans, know exactly how many kids they have, how old they are. And her being a mommy is part of the act.
So even though it's grown beyond playing the state fairs, when you go out on the road, there is still that kind of a little bit of the state fair in your heart element to the whole fanship of it.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
The book is called Lonesome Cowgirls and Honky Tonk Angels, The Women of Barn Dance Radio by Dr. Chris McCusker. The book is from the University of Illinois Press. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. Remember, you can go to www.mtsunews.com and check out the podcast at your leisure, and we're also on iTunes.